Welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. I'm Sean Delaney and I'm glad that you can join me today for our weekly discussion about all matters educational. If you're new to the programme or if you'd like to listen back to any previous editions, you can download any of the 300 plus previous podcasts by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the podcasts tab. This week on the programme, I have an interesting educator in mathematics and other areas for you to meet. Dr. Alf Coles is a senior lecturer in education at the University of Bristol School of Education. He is interested in teacher development, ways of working with video, listening and hearing in the mathematics classroom, early number and creativity in the classroom. He is also knowledgeable on the educator Caleb Gattegno. Dr. Coles' interests grew out of his experience of teaching for several years in secondary schools in the United Kingdom, including running a mathematics department and being an assistant head teacher, and in Africa. His PhD study was centred around the role of discussion in learning mathematics and amongst teachers learning to teach mathematics through discussing videotaped lessons. To begin our conversation, I noted to Alf Coles that he uses video to help teachers and student teachers learn to teach mathematics. I asked him how he does that.
One of the problems with using video that is quite well researched and reported on is that if you show a group of people a video, particularly a group of teachers or teacher educators, people tend to respond quite judgmentally to video. So people tend to look at a video and think, that's not good practice, or I would never be able to do that. My children wouldn't be able to react in that kind of way. And I think there's something quite human here. To be an effective teacher, you have to be very quickly making decisions about what's happening in the classroom. And so what effective teachers have is they have labels for what's going on. So like the class is unattentive or the class is engaged. And those, of course, tend to then be the labels that we interpret video through. So you'll look at a video and think, the class are being attentive or whatever. And maybe the class are disengaged. Those labels for a teacher are very strongly linked to actions. So if I notice a class in a particular way, then there'll be things that I do as a result of that. So again, what that means, if I look at a video and I just interpret it in terms of these labels that I already have, the opportunity for change is very limited because I'm using words that are already linked to things that I do, and it's not clear how I might open myself up to new practice. So the practice that I have used over the last 20 years, it didn't come from me, is to work with short sections of video, 3 or 4 minutes, a continuous clip, and the initial task for the group watching it is just to describe what's happened. And one of my roles as the sort of orchestrator of that discussion is to not allow anyone to trip into evaluation or judgment or any of these other labels like, they look bored. Okay, I'm not going to allow you to say that. What did you observe? Okay, so this student was looking out the window. Well, it may or may not be that they were bored. So we just try and focus on what was done and what was said. And typically what then happens, and we'll re-watch bits of the video, and video is just such a useful tool in that respect because it's so obvious how much we miss. As soon as you re-watch something or hear different people's interpretations, it's really obvious that we're actually making up a lot of what we hear and see. So we might spend 20, 30 minutes just trying to reconstruct this 3 or 4 minute clip of video, re-watching bits and bits of it. And at that point, we then move to a discussion about, so what did you think? Or maybe the group have met to think about reasoning. So it might be, so what was the teacher doing to promote reasoning? Or at this point, the focus of the group might come into play. And what consistently happens is that there's then this rich discussion about possibilities and people. It's like new labels are able to emerge from that discussion, which then have the possibility of opening up new actions in the classroom as well.
So is it moving to a judgmental stage by then, or are you still staying away from judgment after the description?
Well, what is amazing is that people stop judging. So we're definitely trying to move to a more generalised description and a more interpretation, but all of that sort of, I didn't like that, or the kids were bored, just seems to go away. I mean, I wouldn't, it's fine if people then do want to talk in those terms, but what I'm looking for are really, so what was the teacher doing? Why was it effective? I mean, there was one, I audio recorded one group a couple of years ago, and there was just one very stark example of the kind of change that happened. So there was one particular teacher who, even before I sat down, we watched the clip, and I would normally sit down and I'd be expecting to just set up the task for teachers again. Before I'd sat down, the teacher said, I just couldn't help watching that and just seeing all these children was so bored, you know. And so I had to stop that teacher and say, okay, so the task here is to reconstruct. What was it? By the end of that session, that same teacher described what, when she was thinking about what she's got out of it, she's thinking, you know, this has made me realise I just talk so much in the classroom. And that teacher was really allowing space for the children. And so this complete sort of 180 degree switch in perspective had come about for this teacher. And my sense is that if I'd allowed that initial comment of the kids were bored, and of course the first comment in a discussion very much limits or constrains what will happen next, my sense is very little of use would have come out of that. And a lot of research suggests it's very difficult to use video, and my thought would be it's probably because discussion gets into that space very early and then you can't learn anything from that.
How do you select video clips? Because if you're only using 3 or 4 minutes, you need to select good clips or clips that are at least going to be productive for teacher learning.
I have run various different video groups. So most recently I've run a video club in Bristol, where in the very first session I will select a clip. And I select one, a freely available clip online. I select one where I know teachers have quite strong reactions, positively and negative, to it. So that sort of is quite a useful one in terms of setting up the discipline. In these video clubs in Bristol, it's then about teachers bringing along clips of their own video. And they select the 3 or 4 minutes. And what I found is it almost makes no difference whatsoever what we're looking at. So this way of working seems so powerful to me that people bring along anything, and we dwell in the detail of it, and we try and figure out what's happened, and then when we come to analyse it, interpret it, I've never had a discussion where it hasn't felt like rich things have come out of that discussion. And I've often not seen, teachers are bringing along, I've had no control over what teachers are bringing along.
And sometimes as teachers we can be defensive of our teaching. Are teachers ever shy or reluctant to bring along video clips of their own teaching?
The starting point of looking at a video that's not anybody's, that is not someone from the group, seems important. And again, it comes back to this, the way of working is very obviously about not being judgmental. And I think, again, that initial phase where I'm not allowing, and I will be very strong about not allowing judgment, is very significant in terms, I think, then of teachers being happy to bring along their clip, because they know people aren't going to be sitting there saying, oh, I didn't like that.
And are there any, at a practical level, are there any problems with, say, getting permission from parents of children or from children to have classrooms and lessons videotaped?
It's a very delicate issue, And as a university, we at the moment in England are much more nervous about that typically than schools. So a lot of schools will say to parents, will you sign this form saying I'm happy for my child to be video recorded and so on. I mean, we never keep a record of these things in the video club. And there's one quite useful technique where you can make things to look like a comic. So there's a very simple thing that's freely available where you can turn a video into something where just the outlines, you have all the audio channel, But all you see really are the outlines. And so that has helped get over some of the ethical concerns.
As I read through your writing, one researcher that you frequently refer to is Caleb Gattegno. Who was he?
So he was a man who in 1964, I think, was on the front cover of Time magazine. He's been labelled Africa's most significant educator. So those little rods, I mentioned cuisinaire rods earlier, he popularised the use of these rods. And I think I'm right, but I've only heard the second hand. In Canada at some point, every single primary school had a copy of these cuisinaire rods. And they were very popular in England at one stage. So he was an African educator. He worked at the Institute of Education in London for a while. Then moved to New York, set up a company called Education Solutions. His main areas were writing about learning mathematics and learning languages. And he developed really very innovative methods, was an extraordinary educator that inspired a whole generation of mathematics educators in the UK. So we have a group called the Association of Teachers of Mathematics that he helped found and very much was the sort of inspiring force behind. And that's an association that's still going today. I think his work is very widely misinterpreted. He writes in an incredibly difficult style. So I'm part of a group that meets 3 times a year to try and work on some of his writings, and it feels like it needs a group to try and make sense of what he's saying. So I guess if you asked most educators in England at the moment, they would have never heard of his name. So he, at one stage, was very popular and well-respected. And I think it's really the difficulty of his writing, in part, has led to his work not being taken up further. And I think the subtlety of what he was talking about.
In language teaching, one of the ideas he had, it just seems counterintuitive, it was the silent way.
Yes.
I mean, so how would that work for learning a language?
Okay, so there's actually an interesting link between... So when I describe this method of working with video, and I said it wasn't my idea, it came from Gattegno. So what I'm going to describe now about languages, you might see some overlaps. So Gattegno distinguishes between making a noise and making a sound. So his thought is that one of the reasons why we find it so difficult to speak other languages is that we start off trying to make sounds in our language that fit the other language, and that doesn't work. So the only way around that is to try and get learners making noises. And you get them making noises and you hone their noises until they approximate the noises or the sounds in this other language. So what he felt was, if as a teacher I start speaking, that will mean my students try and make sounds in their own language that fit. So I'll start, I mean, I wish I could speak another language effectively to demonstrate a little bit, but maybe imagine like in French, if I start making a French sound, you will make an English sound that is close to it. So what Gattegno advocated is, as a teacher, I make no sound at all to begin with, and I maybe make a mouth gesture and get the class to start making noises. And at the point where somebody's making a noise that is close to the sound I want, I'll focus on that person, try and get everybody saying that, and then associate that noise with a colour. So he would then do this for three or four noises, which are sounds in the new language, and then start tapping on these colours in turn, and the class would start making words by putting these noises together.
Could he demonstrate that it worked?
It's incredibly powerful. And so there's a group in Besançon who continue to use his methods. He, Gattegno, felt you could learn a language a year at secondary school, and you could learn it to a sort of state of proficiency.
Another idea he has is of an energy budget for learning. What is that?
Yes, I mean, this is again his more sort of opaque language, really. But if you just think about if I come back to counting now, not languages, so the labels 1 to 9, in that order, I have to just learn that there's no system behind that. Those are arbitrary. So I've got to pay 9, he would say there were sort of 9 units of energy I've got to pay just to memorise that. And this is again back to this dual naming we've talked about earlier. If I then name English counting in the way I do, I've got to pay another unit of energy for 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. I've got to pay another unit because they're all irregular. If I label things 1T, 2T, then after my 1 to 9, I just need to pay one more unit of energy, the label T, to then count up to 99. And then another label 100 to count up to 1,000. So in a sense, I mean, whether we think that we are spending those units of energy, I don't know. But in a sense, what's powerful there is an analysis of what are the arbitrary things here that a learner just has to be told. You can't invent that. You've got to be told it. And then where is the spaces where the learner then can play with it and try and make it familiar? So he was very precise about what's arbitrary that I just have to tell you, and then where is the space that you can explore.
He also talked about 4 stages of awareness. What
yes.
are they?
Oh, gosh. I mean, this is why his language is so difficult. So I'm not even sure I can remember what the 4 stages of awareness are, to be honest. But, I mean, his writing becomes quite spiritual, to be honest. And so we're into a much more difficult realm here. But I guess if I try and point to a phenomena that I think everybody might recognise, there is some kind of contagion in a classroom, by which I mean that... I spent 17 years teaching, so I see myself as a teacher, and I'm sure any teacher would recognise there's a sense in which a kind of state of mind or maybe a quality of attention or inattention spreads through a classroom. And actually, my state of mind is quite critical to that as a teacher, that in a sense, I don't know, particularly if I'm wanting children to actually engage in something new, to make themselves vulnerable to something new, I have to inhabit a kind of stillness and openness myself. And so whatever his four stages of awareness are, you know, one of the things I feel he's getting at is this idea that I've actually got to work on who I am and how I am in a classroom, as well as all the techniques of curriculum order and so on. One of his sort of aphorisms was, actually the only lesson preparation I can do as a teacher is to prepare myself. And again, it's kind of back to our very first conversation about how can I prepare myself for the unexpected. I've actually got to do some work to be in a space, in a state of mind where I'm open to hear and able to listen to what children bring.
I remember as a beginning teacher educator, this is back in the 90s, I got my students to make geo boards. And wow. I got them to hammer in nails into a board. But what I didn't realise at the time was he developed the geo board.
Yes.
So can you say anything about that, or do you know much about the background to that?
So this Association of Teachers of Mathematics that I said he founded, its original name, and I wonder if I can get it, was something like the Association for Teaching Aids in Mathematics. So he was absolutely fascinated in what resources we could develop to make learning more efficient. You know, he also felt that, and he said he demonstrated, in his practice, that he could teach the entire secondary curriculum, 5 years of mathematics in 18 months, or maybe less. So he felt we were incredibly slow, we were doing things incredibly inefficiently, and so he was developing things like the Cuisenaire rods, the TENS chart, that was the Cattaneo thing as well, the geo boards. He did a lot of work developing mathematical film, and he felt that all these things were ways of allowing the teacher to get in touch with the student's awareness. So he felt this was the thing that went wrong and made learning inefficient, is that we weren't as teachers able to notice what children were aware of and build from that. And it almost cycles back to that very first description of this year two teacher working on multiplication. What she was waiting for, she was setting up situations where children could articulate to her their awarenesses of the situation, and she would work with them and structure the environment so that what she could pick up on was that awareness, if it was multiplication, say, of grouping. And I think that's very much in the spirit of what Cattaneo is talking about, and that if we can do that, learning is incredibly fast. And all these things that seem to be difficult, that we think are difficult, actually aren't if we're able to work with the awarenesses of the children.
If someone was interested in finding out more about his work or just getting into his ideas, where would you advise them to start?
One of his most accessible books is a book called What We Owe Children. And I think that would be one of the places that I might start. And at various times that's been freely available on the internet. I'm not sure exactly the state of it now. But I think that would be the place I'd start.
Alf, you said you spent 17 years teaching. Can you say a little bit about your own route to becoming a mathematics educator and researcher?
I taught for a year in Zimbabwe and a year in Eritrea before training as a teacher in the UK. And I taught then for a couple of years in London. And I was really struggling, to be honest, as a mathematics teacher. So I was teaching in a school in the south of London. And at the end of my first year of teaching, when I was invited to reflect back on it, I didn't actually think I taught a single effective lesson, or sort of a lesson which I sort of thought in any way was effective. I felt that I'd had children in my classes who'd started off quite enthusiastic and keen on mathematics, who by the end of the year had been turned off the subject, and I felt quite responsible for that. I was fortunate to become part of this Association of Teachers of Mathematics, and through that I began working with a mathematics educator called Lorinda Brown, who was actually looking for somebody who was struggling a little bit in their teaching to work with. So she was a teacher educator at that time, and we started working together and very quickly started co-researching. And I guess largely through that working relationship, I began to get a sense of how I might be able to operate in a classroom that might allow me to, I don't know, yeah, I mean, it's this creativity, be creative perhaps. I began to get a sense of what it might be for children to be working mathematically as a group and how I might be able to support that. I engaged in research into my own practice, trying to, I suppose, elaborate and articulate what was going on for me. And then increasingly, I moved to be a head of department. I was interested, and that was where the video work comes in what I was able to do to work with other people. And that led to a master's and then a PhD on exactly those topics. And I guess that sort of inevitably led to the university, really. I mean, the crunch point, as it was I was doing a PhD and working full time, and I realised I wasn't going to be able to finish it in that way. And a part-time job came up at the university, and so that one thing led to another.
And now you have a remit in teaching and researching. How do you balance the different aspects of your work? Because they are different.
They are different, and it's very difficult, and it's a very pertinent question in England at the moment. But I think one of the great shames is that a lot of teacher educators are employed but not given time to do research. So in many institutions there is a separation between staff involved in teacher education and staff involved in research. And I'm fortunate at the University of Bristol that we very much try and get people working across within those two spheres. But it is complex, and yeah, I don't know how I make it work, really, but I suppose, I guess what I'm interested in researching is very closely linked to my work in teacher education. So I'm interested in researching, of course, how children learn in classrooms, but I'm kind of most interested, actually, in how teachers pick up and take up new ideas. So actually my focus really ultimately is on the work with teachers. And so I suppose having a research focus that, although it might appear quite diverse, at its essence is very similar to my teacher education work, I think is one way I get that to work together.
And how do you go about doing your teacher education? How do you plan? What's a class like?
Okay, so this is secondary now. So the teacher education work that I do is secondary mathematics. So one of the things we say very much, and we're very explicit about on our website and interview, is I don't believe there is one way to teach. So what I'm not trying to do in my teacher education work is clone people. So what we're not going to be doing is having sessions where it's like, well, these are good ways to teach algebra. So you might ask, what do we do? So if I just describe, I mean, we've just had the first week of a new term. So one of the things we get all the new teacher education students to do is to prepare something non-mathematical to teach the rest of their tutor group, which is, so they're a group of 30 and they're split into three tutor groups. So the idea really here is, and there's a parallel to the becoming a mathematician label in the primary schools. So we don't see the teacher training year as a sort of an apprenticeship where they become a teacher at the end. We place them as a teacher from the beginning, and we set up the processes by which they need to learn from the very start. So in this first week, they prepare something, a 10-minute thing. It's like hopefully a safe space to practice being a teacher in that very first week of the course. And so they teach something non-mathematical, and the rest of the group then will talk about what did they learn, what helped, what got in the way. So what we're trying to set up is that learning to teach is doing the process, and then reflecting on it with others to try and develop some targets for yourself for next time. So what we're trying to do is, if you like, set up a way of working with experience. And it ties in back to the video work that, again, I think it's very difficult, actually, to come out of a lesson and initially we will think about our own experience in those broad labels. We'll think, oh, that was rubbish, or I got embarrassed about that. And what we're trying to do is get our student teachers to dwell in the detail of their experience and to focus on the detail of particular moments, particular incidents. Try and then think, so what was that about? Why was that incident difficult? Why did that, you know? So maybe it's about, well, actually, how do I know what the kids know? And having identified the issue from the detail of the experience, to then think about, okay, so what might be some options here? What can I do? So it's very much my work is informed by some principles about how difficult it is to learn from experience and how we can get our teachers to be effective at learning from experience.
So if you don't want to produce clones, and I think probably none of us do, at the same time, if you think of, you know, other professions, say if you think about engineers, we don't necessarily want every engineer going out and doing things their own way. We want them to make sure that this bridge is not going to collapse if it's built in a certain way. So are there certain principles that underlie your work that are kind of common to all of the graduates you want, that make them recognisable that these are graduates from the School of Education in Bristol?
Well, the bottom line is the children have to learn. So I'm not advocating kind of laissez-faire. And so if I'm in the back of a classroom and one of my student teachers is teaching, then, you know, we are going to be discussing what anybody has learnt. And if it's clear, and there'll always be a member of staff from the school there, you know, if it's clear the children aren't learning, then we're not going to pull any punches in terms of talking about that. And it's the teacher who's going to have to adapt to that. And if, you know, and the problem might be if the teacher is not recognising that nobody's learning. So the bottom line, I hope, would be that these teachers are effective and they have a sense of how they are going to have how they can develop and grow and learn. But they might be very different in terms of their actual styles, and I would expect that. And I think the engineering example is an interesting one. And I think it's one of the difficulties of education. So it somehow seems possible as a brilliant physicist or engineer to somehow articulate the awarenesses or learning that I've developed through a lifetime in a way that someone else can, in a quite a real sense, pick up from where I left off and do the same and adapt it and develop it. If you consider a sort of an extraordinary teacher like Caleb Gattegno, it's very clear that people are not able to just pick up from where he left off or somehow read his work and develop from there. I think kind of learning to teach, it's much more, I think a sort of much closer analogy would be almost like how our attitudes to, say, gender have changed over the last 100 years. This is about much deeper change, I think. To be able to operate in a classroom in a kind of creative manner is not something I can just read about and do. It's about a change in our whole attitude to what it is to be a learner, what it is to be a teacher. And I don't think these things are very easily pinned down and passed on. I suppose that's why we emphasise the process. What I think we can do and we can be clear about is a process of learning rather than saying this is a really good thing to do in a classroom.
What is the Centre for Researching Education Across Boundaries?
So this is a sort of a loose grouping within the University of Bristol where we try and bring together very diverse research that's happening within the School of Education. Within that, we have a group which perhaps is sort of my more closely involved in, which is the Mathematics Education Research Network. So that'll be one of many groups within the larger centre. I think it's probably more relevant to talk about the Mathematics Education Research Network. And that's an international grouping where we're fortunate that we have people coming from many parts of the world to visit us in Bristol, and we're putting on seminars. So we have our teacher education that runs there. We have a full-time master's programme in maths education with a very international cohort. And we have about 11 or 12 doctoral students. So there's a very sort of thriving and interesting group at Bristol that's under this network banner that's then within this broader centre.
And that was Alf Coles from the University of Bristol bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. I'll bring you the second part of my interview with Alf Coles on next week's programme. If you'd like to listen back to this programme or any of over 300 previous Inside Education podcasts, please go to seandelaney.com. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from good bookshops and online bookstores. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.